Whether you're rich or poor, young or old, healthy or not, or any condition in between, you do have a future. If you don't look out for it, if you don't prepare for it, there's a good chance you're putting yourself and your loved ones at risk. On this edition of Conversations, Paperwork. I'm Susan McGinnis. We'll be talking with attorney Richard Thwaites from Anchorage about the unforeseeable future and how to plan for it. Join us. Dick, thanks very much for coming and sitting down with us for this time.
Glad to be here in Alaska.
Good. The first question I have is that true question? Whether we are living as ants or grasshoppers, carefully preparing for every contingency or enjoying every moment while we have it, one of our jobs on this planet at this time is to look out for our future. That's my assumption. Is that true?
It is true. I think that as a society, we're basically property managers. We manage our property and our affairs and our family in fashions that basically attempt to achieve our goals in life. With our family, I guess, we have aspirations and hopes that things will go the way we want them to go. Sometimes our children don't see it the same way we do. But all in all, I think that's our main goal, is to set things out in a fashion that will follow our overall family plan as best we can, taking into consideration the changes that nature and others deal to us as we go along.
Mm-hmm. When you and I first met, you said something that stopped me cold. You said when the Social Security Administration began and created what we think of as Social Security, it had a particular plan in mind about how long the federal government would offer money to people after they'd retired and when they would cut that off. I would like you to tell that story because it's sobering and thought-provoking. Can you do that?
Well, initially, when the Social Security Administration came into existence, it was to provide supplemental income, especially for those who retired. And the ages of the individuals at which they would start receiving that income in the initial stages of the program was about 62 to 65 years of age. And, of course, at that time in the world, the life expectancy wasn't a great deal past that. And, in fact, I think I've heard some individuals who have talked on behalf of the Social Security Administration and others represent that, in actuality, the average payee only received pay for about 2 years after that. Current times, the demographics have shifted dramatically, and we're now facing a huge shift, the largest growing segment being 85 and over. And I think that I saw a study in the one of the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel's booklets that they send out on a quarterly basis, that one in 20 Americans was about 65 or over in the 70s. And that number has increased now to where it's about one in seven or eight Americans. And they expect after the year 2000 that it'll be approaching one in five to one in four.
It's a
substantial growth in the number of people receiving those benefits.
How is that going to impact individuals and families? It tells me immediately the first logical thing. We're going to live longer. But it means all sorts of new ways of looking at the future.
Well, Dr. Paul Craig in Anchorage, he's a Ph.D. in neurological psychology and neuropsychology, I guess they refer to it as. He had indicated that of the 100 or so participants in the room, that almost all of them could expect to attain the age of 80 or older. The average would be that. So that I think that, generally speaking, we're all going to be living well past that 2 years beyond the time Social Security will pay in, although there's been a recent change. I believe they've moved it to, we'll be moving the age to 67 and maybe sometime in the future up to as far as 70 before you must start receiving benefits.
Okay. So this means to me it's important to take care of ourselves, our elders, our kids, and our future for a lot longer than we thought we might.
Well, multi-generational estate planning has become just a fact of life. Now when I have individuals coming in, and typically People don't like to go in and see lawyers anyway if they can avoid it. It's sort of like going to the dentist or maybe even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do come in, the dilemma is, what do I do for myself and my children? How do I protect those things? And then we are now faced with the continuing consideration of an elder parent that can no longer physically take care of themselves and perhaps very often cannot monetarily take care of themselves. They're in a position where the resources that they have saved are not sufficient for the costs of their care. And those costs differ greatly throughout the United States and are, I'm afraid, as high as they can be anywhere here in Alaska.
Today's subject is paperwork. What are the most important documents we have to think about? And then we'll kind of spread out looking at those documents over time.
Well, the documents that I think are most crucial are first a will. The will is a, they refer to it technically as a last will and testament. It means that the individual has set forth their desires with regard to their property and their family and so forth after their death. Someone else will step in, assume the responsibility for accumulating the assets, paying off whatever obligations might be there, and distributing the property to the individual. So that's the will itself. The other documents that have become increasingly more important are referred to as the living will. You may have heard of that term occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
The Karen Quinlivan case and the Nancy Cruzan case are two cases wherein individuals had been injured and they were maintained on life support for a fairly lengthy period of time. In the Karen Quinlivan case, the issue was, could someone withdraw the life support or could they not? In that particular case, they did in fact withdraw the life support, and she survived for an additional 7 or so years. Subsequent to that, there was a lot of pressure all around the country, and many states, including Alaska, adopted a statute. And here we call it a Declaration of Right to Die, although generically everybody refers to it as a living will. And in fact, one of our statutes, the Durable Power of Attorney statute, refers to the declaration statute as the living will statute, even though that's not what it's called in the books. So that there is a form available, and that form is one wherein the individual can say, if I were there, if I knew I was going to be dying, and if I were there, and if somebody asked me what my decision would be, my decision is to withdraw life support. In Alaska, we can go one step further. We can say, I do want nutrition and hydration, that is food and water, or I do not want nutrition and hydration. Not many states have that option. In the Nancy Cruzan case, the more recent one that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, it was decided that if you did not have one of these living will documents, the decision about whether life support was to be continued or not was not the family's decision, but the state of Missouri. And so that kind of scared us all a little bit, and now it's kind of important to have that piece of paper, as simple as it may be. In fact, most hospitals and so forth actually have the form available when you check in. If you don't have one, they'll offer it to you so that you can fill it out, hopefully with knowledgeable information about which direction to go.
As long as we're on the subject of a living will, I assume if I go into the hospital, I give it back to the doctor or to the administrator and they hold it for me. If I just decide to fill it out, does it need to be notarized, and where do I file it? Where do I put it so that it can be found in the case of an accident or an illness? Or,
well, a zillion options there, but generally speaking, it's a good idea to give a copy of it. It does need to be notarized. It should be witnessed. And when completed, it should be given, a copy of it should be given to your physician and to your other family members and to those that you might feel would be in the know at the time and would know where to locate it. I recommend to my clients that they actually write across the copies that this is a copy and that the original is located wherever it might be. I have a fairly well-to-do client whose family brought in all of his materials to me in a freezer container, one of those Ziploc bag things where they sucked all the air out. And that's not a bad place. That's not going to be burned in a fire.
Because it's in the freezer.
It's in the freezer. The freezer compartment very rarely burns in a fire. And he put it in the protective covering in case the power went out and perhaps some of the other things might have tainted the documents.
You said something about nutrition and water. Why would I put in my living will that I don't want to be revived, resuscitated, but I would like water? What is that?
The living will is only a consideration if your condition is absolutely indefinitely terminable, and it's within a relatively short period of time. If there is any hope for your recovery, they're not going to even consider the living will.
Oh.
So all methods will be used to maintain you in life. It's not any substitute for euthanasia or anything like that. It is purely everyone has ascertained and determined, and usually there are checks and balances on that. For example, most hospitals will not just do one test. They will have one group of staff people do the test at one time, and then on a different shift they will have a second group of test people do it just in case somebody forgot to hook up a wire properly. So once the physician in the hospital has made the determination that the condition is irreversible and that it is terminable within a fairly short period of time, then the family will be consulted about whether or not to remove the life support. Now, in many other jurisdictions, you have the you don't have the decision of whether you want intravenous or nasal nutrition and hydration, food and water. In Alaska, you have the right to make the choice whether you do or do not. I have modified the form that I use in my office slightly to at least permit, if you choose not to have food and water, to at least permit enough hydration to make any medications and painkillers still function.
Oh, I see.
And that was really the recommendation of a couple of physicians. They said that, well, gee, if we do this and we say no water at all, then some of the medications we want will not work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've made that slight modification from the statutory form in our forms to accommodate that.
The things you told me just before you went back to hydration and nutrition tell me that we have to remember that a living will doesn't take care of all contingencies. It just says to my physician and my family, these are my wishes. After that, then my condition and my doctor's opinion about my condition is going to determine really what happens. So I need to not only make out a living will, but go talk to my doctor about how strong a document this is and when it applies?
Well, partially. I believe that the living will pretty much is the very end document anyway. There are a number of states and that have something called a medical directive. And a medical directive is not a living will. It's before the living will. It's discussing what sort of medical procedures and so forth you are willing to permit on your body versus the ones you are not. That document's more applicable to the Alzheimer's patients and the cancer patients and so forth, such as a no-code determination. Some hospitals refer to a no-code, which is the illness is terminal, but you're still conscious and so forth. But you have indicated that you would not like heroic measures used to keep you alive because you know you are dying. And the medical directive is the better document for that. It's permissible in Alaska, but we don't have any statutory authority for it.
Does that mean it would hold?
My experience has been yes, it
okay.
would. And I say that because there is nothing prohibiting it from being there. And certainly any time you can express a concern and the doctor and the hospital and the family are all willing to do that as well, I think it's a valid approach. I think that everyone wants to do what's in everyone's best interest, including the particular patient involved.
Okay. We're talking today with Dick Thwaites. He's an Anchorage attorney. His specialty is estate and gift taxation law. He is a sole practitioner owning his firm, the Law Office of Richard S. Thwaites in Anchorage. He was admitted to the bar in 1974, and has been practicing since then. Have you been in Alaska all that time?
Yes.
Yes. An Alaska long-term resident. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. We started out with the first most important document, and you said that was a will, and then we moved to living wills, which is just fine. But let's go back to a will. A generic question. Why do people avoid wills? Is it that we all want to believe we're going to live forever, or is it because it just feels too complicated?
Well, I think the reasons are all different. I have a number of individuals who are, their life has become a little more complex than normal, and they're perhaps not aware of the Alaska statutes, or the statutes for that matter in any state that provide for the division of property in the event a will is not done, that is, intestate succession. So it's something that's easier to put off rather than to deal with the issues. And sometimes it's not just dealing with the issues, it's the problem, it's that you haven't worked out those issues within your own family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is no single reason. The reasons vary as much as the population varies. Some don't like the topic of death, some don't want to deal with the issue, some say, well, I'll get to that when I need to.
Whenever that is.
Whenever that is right.
So when is that? Should an 18-year-old with a little bit of cash in the bank have a will? Should we have a will when we get married? When does it become important?
Well, I think it varies. I would say that you can't make a will until you're 18 years of age.
Hmm.
But at 18 or after 18, it's not quite so critical if the statutory scheme still works for you. The statutory scheme, the law of intestate succession, would say that your immediate family, probably your parents, would undertake the administration of your estate, and it would pass to them if you had no children or spouse. The next stage in the evolution of complexity, I guess, is when you do get married. And at that point in time, it's not, again, not quite as critical if you don't have large sums of assets that are perhaps bound or tied to some family tree, if you will. I mean, sometimes you have a very rich person that wants something like a prenuptial agreement or mm-hmm. some other mechanism of limiting the transition of the property to their spouse. But barring that, just being married does not, I suspect, absolutely require a will, because the statute would say that the surviving spouse is going to inherit the property. More likely, what you would want to do is control who might do the administration and remove any conflict that would be there with other family members and so forth. So by making a last will and testament, you are telling everyone what your wish and desire was at the time. And I think that removes a lot of the cloudy and foggy issues about what you wanted to do in the event of that circumstance.
And that's, barring great wealth, that's what the point of a will is, isn't it? To be a voice after one's death?
Yes.
Yes. And that voice is strong because it has the law behind it, it has the courts behind it.
It actually goes back to English law, and it's one of the strongest concepts in our legal system, that it takes a horrendous amount of evidence and a horrendous amount of non-conflictable evidence, if you will, something that is very, very clear, to override what might be in a written document. So that's given a strong presumption in the law, very strong.
About a living will, you said it was wise to have it notarized and make sure copies got around to the people who might be there when something happened. About a will, you hear about wills that are written on the back of a napkin and stuffed in the drawer of the dresser. Is that still legal?
In Alaska, a holographic will is a will written all in your own handwriting.
Holographic.
And it's called a holographic will. And those are perfectly valid. In fact, if you were a citizen and resident of Alaska, and Alaska is your domicile, and you do a holographic will and then move to another jurisdiction that doesn't recognize those. For example, the state of Washington will not allow a holographic will. But if you did one while you were in Alaska and then you moved to Washington, Washington will recognize that document.
Uh-huh, because it was done here where the law applies.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Are there most important things about wills that we need to know before we set out to do one?
Well, yes. When you do a will, one of the very first things you do is you sort of clear the slate. And I think one of the very critical things is to say who your family members are and to say, I hereby revoke all prior wills and testamentary documents, so that you don't have any confusion. Excuse me. You may recall that when the Native Land Claims Settlement Act came through, the ANSCA stock, the native stock, had some special characteristics with it. And those special characteristics required, in essence, some form of will.
Mm-hmm.
So some people got the bright idea in the various offices to go ahead and create a will form, and they drew up a form. And I have had a couple of estates where there have been six simultaneous wills being done, because they had done one in 1974, one in 1975, one in 1978, one in 1979, and so forth, without revoking any of the prior documents. And so what you are forced to do is you are forced to take the first will and make and administer any provisions in that that haven't been overdone in the subsequent ones. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of read all four or five of them together. So it's very important when you do a holographic will or any type of will to make a statement that I hereby revoke everything else I've done in the past. And this, right now, the one I'm doing today, is my last will and testament. And I mean it to revoke all of the others. And then you can go ahead and set out who you want to have the administration accomplished by and how you want the property to pass.
Okay.
Typically we leave the residuary to the main beneficiary, whoever that might be, our spouse or
residuary.
Our family. Residuary. Well, let's say that in the will I say, I want my boat to go to so-and-so, I want my art collection to go over here, I want this book to go to so-and-so, and everything else I have left over, that's my residuary.
Goes to Harry.
Goes to my wife and children.
Right, okay.
So that we can do the distribution of the initial bequests with the residuary going in the direction that we want. And that residuary is the what's left over after we make the other decrees.
Okay. This is Dick Thwaites. We're talking about paperwork, and the subject is wills on Conversations. You said I can write it on the back of the napkin and stuff it in a drawer. If I'm being smart, when should I bring an attorney in, or should I bring an attorney in without advertising for the field?
Well, I think that when there are other individuals who are in need of assistance where they aren't going to directly control the assets, a minor child,
okay,
a parent that's going to need some assistance, a spouse who might need some assistance, such as a... And the term that we use there usually is a trust. That's a document that can be created not outside of the will, but right in the will itself, a testamentary trust, where essentially I say my residuary estate passes to my brother Tom as trustee for my children. And then I tell Tom that I want him to go ahead and pay it out to my children under certain terms and conditions. Many of those terms and conditions might be pay for their education and everything else until they get to a certain age, and then pay them a certain portion of that share coming to them. And then when they turn 28, pay them some more, and when they turn 32, pay them the remainder.
Mm-hmm.
The ages aren't magic. Nothing is magic. It doesn't need to be three payments. It doesn't need to be one payment. You can be as flexible as you want to fit your family's circumstance, and that would be a testamentary trust. I think that's the most important thing. Likewise, if you have complex assets, if you have assets that are sort of need special administration, mm-hmm, like a business, a closely held business, or you are in partnership with someone else in a business and you want someone to step in because you haven't dealt with the business assets outside of a will, you want the language then structured in a way that will permit your executor, or in Alaska we refer to them as a personal representative. The personal representative will be able to step in and handle that administration. And for that person, it's very important that their authority is clear, it's concise, and it's unequivocal. You don't want them having to fight battles on the side just to make the asset stay with your family in the way that you had intended.
Are there awful stories of people with good intentions who don't get some advice and...
Oh, there are many, many stories that way. And quite frankly, I think that, at least in my practice over the last 20 years, it's been my experience that lawyers tend to make the most money where the family situation, the business assets, and everything else haven't been dealt with on a proper planning basis. And there are unclear resolutions of issues, and so they're fighting with one another in and amongst the family situation. Penny wise, pound foolish, I guess is the phrase. The developing an adequate estate planning document, the will, the living trust, perhaps maybe even a durable power of attorney, that is so critical because you can spend a little bit of effort and time up front doing that and save a lot of hassle down the road,
mm-hmm,
just a whole bunch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Dick Thwaites, an attorney who has offered his services to us for an hour for a good price. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Now, I wanted to ask you about one more thing relative to wills. Let me stop and think here. If there is a minor child, or if there is a parent, an elder, another relative who needs looking after, how do I pick the person I want to do that? And what do I sit down and talk to them about? I know this is not a lawyer's field particularly, but it's the kind of field that if we don't want to think about our death or we don't want to think about disability, we may have trouble thinking through. You've done this a lot. What would you suggest to people?
Well, I think it's important to find out first what the responsibilities of that person might be. I've had a number of people who have accepted the responsibility of being a personal representative in someone's estate, and after they've gone through it once, because the planning wasn't exactly proper or because they didn't know exactly what they were supposed to do, they come away with a bad experience and say, I'll never do that again for anybody. Mm-hmm. And those are also most of the people that come in and do the estate plan very quickly, too, once they've been through that process. But in that scenario, I think it's very critical for the family to know who there is amongst the family that will assume these responsibilities. If you have a clan meeting of so forth, there are in most families people who are willing to step in and assume that. In Alaska, I've lived up here since 52, so I've got a lot of ties in the state. Mm-hmm. But many people have ties outside of the state of Alaska. They've only come in the last 10 or 15 years, and most of their family is located elsewhere, and so it creates a lot of difficulty and a lot of problems about what to do in the interim. In fact, in many of our wills, we've put in what we call a temporary guardian. A temporary guardian is just somebody in the locale where you're located that will step in for a month or two or three, whatever it takes, to get the children through that semester of the school, and then allow a transfer to the more permanent residence or guardian.
Today on Conversations, paperwork. We're looking at how to deal with our future. Our guest, Dick Thwaites. Well, I listened to you recently in an evening workshop, and you said, someone suggested I put a sign on my side of the desk that says, be warned, the person you're looking at may not be telling you the truth. How important is it when anyone, me or anyone else, comes to an attorney to set out a will or any other document, that that person tells you the whole truth, no matter what?
Well, I don't think that we hook up the lie detector to any clients to verify a test of a number. But generally speaking, everyone has their own privacy that they want to maintain. Mm-hmm. And that privacy is such that they will only give the lawyer the information they think is necessary for that lawyer to do the task at hand. And if they know what they want to do and they have pretty much in mind where that's going to go, then all I need to tell the lawyer is X, Y, and Z. And what I tried to explain at the meeting the other night is that occasionally there are conflicts between a husband and a wife that oftentimes you must advise them that that as a lawyer you might want to tell them something inconsistent, that what's best for one is not good for the other and mm-hmm. vice versa. So they have to know that and understand that conflict and be willing to waive that before you can represent both of them. Well, that conflict is even further magnified when you deal with other members of the family as well. Sometimes in the past, we've had one spouse or the other who had perhaps a skeleton in the closet that was never revealed. Mm. And that skeleton might have been a child or something from a prior relationship that didn't exist prior to their meeting, or the worst case, maybe it came in after they had met and so forth. But nonetheless, that child has some impact and is due to inherit something from the estate if they step forward. It certainly is easier to deal with that if you know about it.
My thinking is that it might be easier to tell the truth up front than to deal with the fallout afterwards, or for the family to be dealing with the fallout afterwards.
Yes. Okay. And I think what you can do there is if you have some problem with it, come back and talk to the attorney later. And I've had that happen before where someone comes in after our initial meeting from one side of the relationship or the other and asks me some questions, and I try to lay out what I think the issues are and how that could be impacted by the documents they're going to do.
Okay. So even if it's uncomfortable, not only thinking ahead, but thinking about your particular situation as honestly as possible and sharing at least everything that's absolutely important to share with the attorney to get the best advice.
If you want it to come out the way you want it to come out, yes.
Right.
There could be no guarantees any other way.
Okay. All right. This is Conversations. We're talking with Dick Thwaites. I'm Susan McInnes. When we go into relationships, we go in with a full heart and a lot of hope and the assumption that this relationship, this marriage, is going to be forever. Once again, I know you're not a divorce attorney, but there's so much divorce in this country at this time, and there's so many situations where people get angry, they take the money, take the property, make sure it's in their own name, and slide away. Is there a way for people to both go into relationships with a full heart and a lot of hope and also look after themselves? Or is this just a lottery?
No, there are many, many mechanisms for doing that. Alaska is a separate property state, and while the divorce court arena, if you will, tends to treat spouses as though they must share everything, at least half of everything, even under that concept, still belongs to one or the other. In Alaska, we are a separate property state, which means that if I came into a marriage with $500,000 and my spouse came into the marriage with $50,000, I could keep the $500,000 separate from the $50,000 if I wanted to. And as long as I didn't commingle my $500,000 in our marital community, it would stay my property. And this is even true with the federal tax law. They have created actual provisions within the tax code that would permit, in a second married situation, one spouse having property, assuring themselves that that property will pass to their children, mm-hmm. not the spouse and the other children, while at the same time perhaps providing an ongoing interest to their surviving spouse, but one that their surviving spouse couldn't change or alter down the road. When you get into those kinds of complex situations, I would never, ever recommend a holographic will.
Yes.
I do a lot of planning for judges and lawyers and others for that reason. It becomes more technical.
All right. Now, let's move on. You said there were three documents that were very important. We looked at the will, we looked at a living will, and the durable power of attorney, you believe, is the last most important document.
Yes. In Alaska, the will only comes into effect, well, in all states, it only comes into effect at your death. The living will is only effective when you are about to die, mm-hmm. and you must be dying before that has any merit, and it's a very, very narrow purpose. But there is a much greater probability that we become disabled, that we can't handle our affairs, especially as our population ages. Traditionally, the mechanism for dealing with management of assets under a disability was a living trust, and that is still a perfectly acceptable mechanism. If we don't have a living trust and we don't have a durable power of attorney, the court system can come in and impose a guardianship and a conservatorship. A guardianship is someone to care for the person. The conservatorship is someone to care for the person's property. And the guardian and conservator can be one and the same person. In other words, but they have the power to split them up and say, you manage property only, or you manage the person only, or you manage the person and the property, or property only, person only, you know, any one of those combinations. But that requires a fair expense because two lawyers are involved, and it takes under our statute probably 3 or 4 months to go through the hearing processes to ascertain incompetency, to make a fair determination that a guardianship or conservatorship is necessary.
Boy, I see money flying out the window everywhere.
You do,
yes.
And it does.
Yes.
The alternative is a statutory form durable power of attorney, and that's a mechanism that's in the statutes, and that if properly executed, it can be one that has that's in place and operative now, or it can be one that's in place and not operative until you became disabled. So, I mean, you have a lot of flexibility. But it's voluntary, it's inexpensive, it's revocable, and you don't do any accounting to the court. And it can do all of the things that a conservatorship or a guardianship could do.
When you say durable power of attorney, this doesn't mean I am passing control over myself or my assets to an attorney. This is something different. I can pick someone.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes. I am an attorney at law. I have been licensed by the Alaska Supreme Court and the statutes of Alaska to practice law and to give advice regarding the statutes of Alaska. So I am an attorney at law. In a durable power of attorney, you appoint an attorney in fact. And that doesn't have to be a lawyer. It could be your spouse. It could be anyone that you rely on or would want to rely on for handling these affairs. And it is a very, very broad document. So broad that it should be very cautiously entered into. In fact, if you look at the statutory form, just about every other paragraph throughout the form is a warning by the legislature. Mm. It is a warning to the person signing it that that's a powerful document. It's a warning about how you can revoke it at any time. It's a notice to third parties that they can rely on the word of the person having this form. So with that in mind, and back to our other where do you keep it mm-hmm. question, mm-hmm. The only one that's any good is the original of that. And I would mark copy over any copies that I had, and certainly individually I would retain custody of my own power of attorney. Should I have given one to you, I would keep the original and I would give you a copy and say, by the way, if I ever become disabled and you need to use this, go to my freezer in the garage or go to the safety deposit box at National Bank of Alaska or mm-hmm. wherever and recover the original and then use the original.
Okay. And right now is all we need to know about the durable power of attorney is that it applies guardianship and conservatorship over person and assets?
Yes, it can do both.
All right.
In other words, it covers your real estate and personal property and banking and insurance and government benefits and health care and all kinds of things. The one limitation in the form, and this is one that's very often overlooked, is that the attorney, in fact, cannot make a transfer of any property to themselves or anyone they have an obligation to support. So the legislature said this is so powerful that the presumption is you don't have the power to transfer to yourself. You do not have that power. And then it says right in the statute, if you do want to give that power to someone, then under O, category O, which is other matters, then you have to expressly state in that category that I want this person to be able to give something or transfer property to themselves or to someone they have an obligation to support.
Okay. Now, we talked about this, you and I, before we sat down, but the quick question is, on each of these three documents, or all of these three together, how much work should the individual do by him or herself, and when do we call the attorney in?
Well, that I think it helps to maybe go to a couple of meetings or seminars or something and learn as much as you can so that the basic vocabulary and the scope of the documents and so forth are generally known to you, not specifically but fairly generally, so that when they talk about a power of attorney or a living will or a will or a living trust for that matter, that you kind of understand what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
To get in and discuss these things, you must have some basic understanding. That's a tough question, though, because in my experience, most people don't understand the documents until we come in and talk for an hour or so, and I kind of find out sort of what they want, and then I give them back something in writing with their names on it and sort of lays out a general picture.
Mm-hmm.
And when they can go through and read the document, and hopefully it's in English, I try to stay away from legalese as much as possible. But if they can come back and read the document to themselves and so forth, and then they understand, and then they come back and have questions, the second visit we are much better able to communicate back and forth what their desires are and how they want that done. I find a lot of individuals wanting to simplify their distribution pattern because when they suddenly discover all the wishes and desires that they had and they forget about the conflicts that are it naturally raises between children. Very often they want to streamline the plan and get it back to something that will work fairly easily for the family. With the trauma of losing a loved one, you don't want to add to that the complexity of having to deal with a lawyer day in and day out and all the administrative agencies as well.
Dick Thwaites is with us today on Conversations. We're talking about paperwork. A little background on Dick Thwaites. He is a fellow in the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel with the National Academy of Elder Law Lawyers, and he's been active with the Anchorage Estate Planning Council. He's past chair and is currently active with the Probate and Estate Committee of the Alaska Bar Association. Dick Thwaites is also the seniors representative for the Mental Health Coalition in this state. He is currently an adjunct faculty member of the University of Alaska Anchorage and Charter Colleges, where he teaches business law, real estate law, and probate administration. Attorney Dick Thwaites with us today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is a question I could not decide whether to ask you or not, but I'm going to. Attorneys tend to have a bad reputation. I want to know why and how much of it is deserved. And then I want to ask you the logical question for a consumer, which is how do I go about getting over myself relative to attorney's reputation and go about picking one out? So the first question is any part of the bad reputation that attorneys have deserved? And what do you think about that?
Well, a recent study by the American Bar Association, I think it was in either the August or the September issue, polled, you know, they hired a pollster to go out and kind of ask the questions. And I thought the answers were sort of illuminating. Lawyers were right down there, I hate to say this, with reporters and used car sales. So we weren't very high up on the list. And their analysis was, after interviewing, the second part of the interview was a follow-up, which is why. And fully 90% of those questions said, well, my attorney's okay. The only problem I have with my attorney is they don't answer the phone calls as often as perhaps I'd like them. But it's the other guy's attorney that I don't like.
Interesting.
And so that says to me that, well, anytime you're in an adversary relationship, you certainly don't like the guy that's carrying the opposition's sword. Mm-hmm. That's a good reason for not liking the other side. And so I suspect that we have gotten into that image. It's not the image of my lawyer, because he's a friend of mine. It's the image of the other guy's lawyer and all the other lawyers out there that we're not going to like. And I think a lot of people have had some fairly... I had some recent experience with some clients, and I don't do a lot of litigation. But I had experience with clients of mine who worked with a litigation lawyer. And that lawyer tried to control their lives. In that, to get the job done, he needed them to accomplish certain things. And no one likes to be talked to like they are in the second grade. Even second graders don't like that.
Yes.
So the lawyer sees a task, and certainly, you know, they may only be representing that client during this one thing, and they want to get the best for that client at that time. I would guess that if the outcome is good, they like the lawyer. If the outcome is bad, they don't like the lawyer. That's natural.
Okay.
So I think that's part of it. I think that as a society, we have become basically litigious. Everyone has rights. And we don't compromise, perhaps as much as we ought to, when it comes to making our rights mesh with the rights of our neighbors. You know, I don't care if your fence is only 3 inches on my property. Mm-hmm. I insist that you move it over. 3 inches isn't going to impact my life or the other person's life, but if you don't like the way their kids play in their yard or if their kids are too loud or something like that, that might be enough, coupled with the other infringement, to want us to talk to our lawyers. And I don't think that's really necessary in our society.
Okay. Now, when I need a lawyer, how do I pick one out? Is this a very personal choice that I make based on my needs? Or should I trust that a person who specializes in a particular area of law can help me, no matter who that person is?
I think that's a harder question. I think the question of locating a lawyer that you want to work with is... is, number one, it has to be somebody you can communicate with. If you can't communicate with the individual, there's no point in dealing with it. And sometimes that just isn't going to happen, even though the person might be an expert in the field. So I would talk to those people that I know, friends of mine, that might have talked with other lawyers in that particular field. And I would say, maybe go to the phone book and say, well, gee, there are these four or five lawyers in here that seem to indicate these are their specialties. And by indicating that these are their specialties, you can ask people what they think about the lawyer. That isn't always a good indication, I don't think, because people who want to do that work, who may not be getting that work, are going to advertise to get the work in. For one, I have not done anything in the way of advertising. If you look in the Anchorage phone book, my name is listed in there once, and that's it. Primarily because most of my work comes from referrals. I get lawyers and judges and clients and everyone else referring people to me. And recently we've started a little growth spurt in our office. There are now three of us doing this sort of work, so we're coming to Fairbanks more often and also going down into the Juneau area more often. But that's because we've chosen to kind of do that, and probably we will start putting ourselves in the estate planning and so forth category, but we haven't to this point in time. So advertising is an indication that people are willing to accept that type of work. The Bar Association's lawyer referral service is the same thing. The lawyer will pay a certain fee for the Bar Association to tell them that they are willing to accept work in that area. But no lawyer in Alaska specializes in any one area because we don't have certified specialties. So it's sort of like, well, what kinds of cases do you accept? And I try to limit my practice to those that I feel more comfortable with and that I can do the client the best work with. I have been forced on a few occasions by very close clients and friends of doing some work that I didn't feel that comfortable with. And so I would try to associate other counsel that I thought could do a better job at it than I could, just because I thought they were a friend and I wanted them to have that sort of help. Mm-hmm. But talking with others and talking with the lawyers themselves. Most lawyers will, you know, in our office, if someone walks in and they spend 25 or 30 minutes with me and I don't think I can do for them what they need to have done or that we're not going to get along or something like that, they're free to leave without any charge or expense at all. And I don't know of any lawyer that won't do that. Okay. There may be a few out there, but
okay, that gives us some good starting points. We've got maybe 10 minutes left, and I don't want to leave this hour without some time to take a look at one of the topics we started with, which is that we're growing older, we're living longer, and we may, in the course of living longer, run into a catastrophic illness, Alzheimer's disease, an accident, things we can't foresee that's going to change our situation quite completely. Insurance may be problematic. Finances may not be sufficient. What ways can we look ahead now to look after ourselves in futures that are right now unforeseeable?
Ooh, that's hard to answer because I...
Pick parts.
I don't know. I'm frustrated with the overwhelming increase in the demand for entitlements, which are the welfare programs and so forth. I see a huge increasing demand on those entitlements, while at the same time the population is wanting to restrict the amount of tax that would go to those. They want to provide those monies elsewhere. And I think that as a society, we as individuals have to start focusing more on caring for ourselves and our families in ways that are more efficient and insisting on programs that will consolidate and provide services without duplication. Right now, for example, in Alaska, the Medicaid assistance for, say, a nursing home, an Alzheimer's patient, if they could get into a nursing home, they would have to have some sort of designation other than Alzheimer's. Because our state statute, or I shouldn't say our state statute, I should say the regulators within the state have not defined Alzheimer's as a physical impairment, it's a mental impairment. Even though it's an organically caused mental impairment, it in and of itself is not sufficient to allow you to get on Medicaid for assistance. Medicaid is available if there is a physical need for going into a nursing home, and Alzheimer's is not considered physical, even though they can't care for themselves. But let's say that you had an Alzheimer's patient with diabetes that required insulin. Then it would be sufficient. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, they could only have $1,302 a month in income and about $6,000 worth of assets between a burial plot and a checking account and some insurance and some other things.
To be eligible for Medicaid.
To be eligible for the Medicaid. In Alaska, the monthly care cost is about $10,000, $8,000 to $10,000, depending on where you are in the state. For a husband and wife, that means you have to have income around $30,000 a month. And I've told that to a few clients, and they said, oh, I'm covered. I'm making $40,000 a year. No, I said $30,000 a month. They said, a month? Well, how do you figure that? And I said, well, it's $10,000 for you, $10,000 for your spouse,
my.
And then $10,000 for Uncle Sam, because you have to pay the taxes on the money that you've earned. And so that's about $30,000 a month if you don't want to invade your corpus and so forth. So it's a terribly expensive thing. And I don't know how to plan for that other than making sure that you have family members and locations and things that you can get to. Mind you, the cost is not nearly as staggering. And in fact, Oregon has a program, or many programs, where the average cost is only about between $2,000 and $2,800 a month, because they have very successfully, since 1980, broken the programs into where they have much more in-home care. And for many Alzheimer's patients, that's all that's required. They don't need the actual nursing care. They need someone who can feed them and dress them and clothe them and make them get out and walk around and protect them.
Is this in the future for Alaska? What goes on elsewhere? Do we have to change our ways?
We are in the process. We have a lot of systems going on right now looking at that. But we are such a diverse population geographically that it's horribly complex to try and get all of those resources out there. The other thing, I think, is that if you look at our Pioneer Home system and the nursing home systems and everything else here in the state of Alaska, you will find that their staffing and everything is just absolutely tops. It's unequaled, I think. And I have been in nursing homes outside of the state of Alaska, and I've been in nursing homes here, and I work with the Mary Conrad Center Community Advisory Board in Anchorage, and they were awarded the number, the top nursing home in the country a couple of years ago, and it's because of the quality of service and the quality of care that we get here. Elsewhere, I've been in another state where basically everyone in the nursing home is getting minimum wage, mm-hmm. and the cost isn't nearly as high, and it's a get-by mentality. And I've seen people waiting at the front door. I mean, everybody in the morning, as soon as they get out of their bed, they crowd to their front door, and the first person who comes through the door, they want them to take them with them. Mm-hmm. That's not a wonderful picture for our golden years. And baby boom hits the 65 mark in the year 2015, and we're not prepared. So, this just feels like I'm kicking everybody in the side when I talk about this, but I don't see any great hope without each individual family doing the planning and so forth that's necessary just to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that planning means investment. The planning also means staying as healthy as possible,
yes.
Does it not?
Mostly staying as healthy as possible.
Mm-hmm. And also, I would guess you would suggest, and I will just ask you this, does it mean that we also want to be a part of our political process in the state of Alaska so we can decide how to compromise between cost and quality of care and keeping our state able to afford its part of the future?
Yes, by all means. I mean, if I were, I'm kind of an advocate for that anyway, and I've participated in many of the senior programs, but I think that it's very important for us all to get out there and encourage as many community programs as possible, and I think that we as a society have to change our outlook on what and who an elder is. It are us, and we're going to have to start dealing with that. And the alternative of becoming old is dying, I guess. So when you consider the two choices, becoming old is probably a good choice, and wanting to do that in a way that we can enjoy life and our families and everything else can be absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so planning to do that is very important. The legal side of it is, the legal side deals with the transition points. It deals with the transition points of having to go from caring for yourself to Medicaid coverage. It has to do with the transition from caring yourself to having someone else care for you in the event of disability, or from transitioning the property from one family member when that family member dies to the remaining family members. So all of this paperwork that we're talking about is just absolutely critical for doing that. I got into this kind of personally, and what happened was my mother developed Alzheimer's, and I've been dealing with that now for about 10 or 11 years. And so that's how I got started back in the early 80s. Well, recently, myself and another lawyer that I had hired where my mother resides, they had retired outside to take care of my father's parents. Mm-hmm. That lawyer and I got together and decided it was time to try and get my mother into this nursing home. And we ended up having to hire two other lawyers, one for my father and one for as a guardian ad litem to represent my mother. So I'm a lawyer that works in this area. The other lawyer works in the area, and he represented me to help my mother. I had a lawyer that I had to hire for my mother. My father had a lawyer, so there were four lawyers involved. And I thought, gee, with all of us and all the knowledge that we had, we could get this thing done in 10 days. It took me 4 months because the paperwork and the application process, the first time somebody didn't submit the right information to us, one of the banks didn't. And of course, if you didn't have the right information into them on the first of the month, then it delayed it to the next month. The next month, when they got the proper information in, the person who sent the information off to the state capitol forgot to send all of the information. That bounced it for that month. By the time the third month came around, the application, the Medicaid application program, was over 60 days old and had to be resubmitted. So by the fourth month, they reactivated the application by just doing a duplicate application, putting a new name on it, and getting it through. Now, this is four professionals in the area. It took 4 months to do it. What is the layperson going to do?
I'm amazed.
It's horrible. Now, I haven't had that kind of experience here in Alaska. I think that the experience I've had has been pretty good. Everybody's been very positive toward making this thing work. And I think Alaskans generally have still the same attitude that I remember as a child and growing up here, that we will help each other. And believe me, that is the most important thing, I think, and that's why I'm still here and I'm still trying to help others as well. So,
the few things you would leave people with are plan ahead, make sure you include everything in your thinking, consult a good advisor, and don't expect it to be easy.
Exactly.
That's what I've gotten out of our hour together.
Well, I don't think you can expect it to be easy. I think that it will be a lot easier if you have all the planning and documentation in place, mm-hmm. if you know what to expect.
Okay.
It's the uncertainty that we can't deal with, and the frustration of having someone go through all of these problems and then being confronted with a nightmare of administrative entanglement. And that's the most horrible thing you can face when you've already facing the loss of a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a long time coming to get it, things accomplished.
Okay. Paperwork. Do it. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks very much to Dick Thwaites for spending time with us. We have had the thoughts of an attorney for the past hour on the work we must get done. Best to you. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week. Thanks very much, Dick.
You're welcome.